And it's good to be back with you. It's been said that we are probably no more than 20 years away from a barbarian culture. A few years ago, I would have taken that statement to think it's a bit pessimistic. With the rapid changes that we've seen over the last few years, it may be pretty much on target. Well, one of the beautiful things is, as the children of God, we don't have to be part of that. It doesn't mean we will have a barbarian culture, but it does mean that it hinges on how the coming generation is led and responds. My thoughts this morning are from a lesson I gave a few months ago at a meeting in which I was assigned this topic, and the elders have asked me to share some of those thoughts with you. And the title I was given at that meeting was Child Whisperers. And I'm going to read just a few sentences of what they asked me to talk about, which will help explain what you're going to hear in the next few minutes. How do we as parents and congregations help our young people get on their feet and take responsibility for deciding on career and vocation? How do we train them to take a role as responsible Christians? This includes such things as providing for themselves and their families, accepting responsibility for their part in the congregation. What is the difference, if any, between leading, training, and controlling? How do we do this so that we effectively work ourselves out of a job and our young people become independent, responsible adults making their own choices? What I really liked about that assignment was it was a congregational tenor that they gave it to me. And that's the way I want to address it this morning. This is not a lesson on how to be a good parent. There will be some of those aspects that will at least portray some of my thoughts on that. But you might remember several years ago, well, maybe a couple of decades ago, there was a phrase came out about raising our children that said it takes a village. And many of us didn't care too much for that because really it was a theme on how the government has to help you raise your children rather than you do it. And I don't think I disagree with the tenor of that statement, but I do think it takes a congregation sometimes. When I look at my two boys who are raised, grown, and gone, I can't begin to count the number of people who were not blood relatives of theirs that did a tremendous amount in shaping their thoughts spiritually and emotionally, financially. So I do think the congregation as a whole, and I say that because many of us don't have children at home anymore, or maybe we've never had them for various reasons. That's absolutely fine. But we all have an opportunity, and I suspect, although they didn't tell me this, the elders asked me to talk about this, not because there is a immediate problem, but with the demographics of this congregation, and I suspect those demographics will continue, you have a lot of children and young people coming up the pike, and how can we as a congregation help these youngsters grow into the adults that we want them to be? Maybe I could even say the adults we wish we were. But for some of you, the adults that you are. When I looked up the term whisperer, it simply means a person who whispers. And if you're a parent with young children at your feet right now, probably before I am done, there will be times you wished your children would whisper. And they may or may not. It's kind of amazing to me. The people who whisper loud are the young and the old, because the old don't know they're doing it because they can't hear and the young don't care. But to take this a little bit further, a whisperer, as it's used in this term, is a person who is skilled in taming and training a specific kind of animal, typically using body language and gentle voice encouragement. And on TV in the last few years, there's been various shows, Horse Whisperer, Dog Whisperer. I remember when I first saw that title, Dog Whisperer and Horse Whisperer, I was just intrigued what that was. So I watched it and I thought, that's kind of stupid, so I didn't watch it anymore. It may work. And then I came across a book that came out a year ago by Carol Tuttle entitled The Child Whisperer. And I thought, that's exactly what I need to read for this lesson. But I read on the cover, it says, The Ultimate Handbook for Raising Happy, Successful, Cooperative Children. And I knew I was in trouble because her book couldn't be the ultimate handbook on it because we already have the ultimate handbook, don't we? When I think of that, I always think of Brother Tom Woody. He and Lou Ann were going to one of those parent-teacher conferences, and the teacher was complimenting them on how well-behaved their children were, and I'm sure that's the same thing all of you hear when you have a parent-teacher conference. And the teacher looked at Tom and said, You ought to write a book on this. And Tom just looked at her and said, The book's already been written. But in this book, she puts them in the four categories. And if you've ever been to sales marketing meetings or psychological things, you put people in these boxes and you react to them. And there's some truth to that, but it's not the answer. There are different stages and areas of our growth, whether it's spiritual growth, mental growth, physical growth. It doesn't really matter in the sense that there's no way to rush through any of those stages. I do not believe there is a microwave formula for growing. There's only a crockpot formula. And if it's done right, you end up with something that's well done and tender. Crockpots are convenient, but one of the best things for me about a crockpot, it doesn't matter how bad the meat is. If you put it in there long enough, it gets tender. I think you could put a shoe in a crockpot, and it might not be tasty, but I think it would get tender. Spiritual growing up is crockpot time. And by that I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. It didn't for you and it didn't for me. In our stages of growth, whether it's physical or spiritual, there is first of all birth and infancy. That's called the help me stage. Peter wrote about that in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, where it says, desiring the sincere milk of the word. That's before we're able to digest the meat. It's interesting that human beings in almost every facet when they're first born are the most helpless of all creatures. A little foal is born and in a few hours he's up walking around or maybe even galloping around. We have children, and please don't be offended by this, but for a few months they're helpless. We kind of like that, I guess. It makes us feel important. But if you didn't care for them, they'd starve to death. They'd die. It's a time of intense dependence. It's a time of little concept of danger, no discernment. And then we move into a childhood. We'll call this maybe 2 to 7 year old, whatever. And I think that you could call that a teach me stage. They're just like sponges. They're absorbing everything they see and hear. Even if we don't want them to absorb everything they see and hear, they do. They may not come up to us and say, teach me, but by their actions, that's what's happening. And if you're an adult, there have been times when young children in this stage are watching you and you wish they weren't. But you don't have that choice. It is a period of learning. It's that time when you get lots of why, and then you'll answer that, and they'll say, well, why? And then you'll answer that, and you'll say, well, why? And eventually you get tired of the why, and you say something profound like, because I said so. But they're just grasping for knowledge. And I see this in spirituality. A newborn in the church has this intense interest. If we could just maintain that as we get a few more years under our belt. And some of you have done a good job of that. But it's also an era of not being terribly discerning. Most of the pictures of children we see on milk cartons are in this age bracket. Because someone comes up to them and says, I've got a puppy in the car, you want to pet it? They pet it and off they go. Tragically. And then we move to youth. whether you want to define that as the teen years, I'll let you define it, but it's a little more discerning, but it's a period of ambivalence and extremes. It's a very opinionated period. One man said it's the period of idealistic thinking with unrealistic expectations, and I think that's pretty good. It's that time when our young people, emotionally, spiritually, start saying, show me. You've been telling me this for years. Now let me see it in your life. They're saying to us, okay, put your money where your mouth is. You've been telling me these are all the right things to do. Let me see it in your life. And when they don't see it in our life, we often lose them. I am often asked, what's the key to a congregation to grow? Well, I don't know the answer to that. If I did, I'd write a book and donate the funds to some charity. But there is a very strong tie between church growth and keeping our young people. What I don't know for sure, whether we keep our young people and that causes us to grow, or the things that causes us to grow allow us to keep our young people, and it may be a little bit of both. But I have yet to see a congregation that doesn't keep young people grow, whether it's a cause or effect or a little bit of both. But if we in the church wait until our young people get to be that age before we get our act together and are concerned about this, it is probably too late. It's like raising a teenager. If you wait to worry about how that teenager is going to turn out until they become a teenager, it's probably all over by then. No, it has to begin young, doesn't it? And I think that's true spiritually. The key to successful adolescence is successful infancy and childhood. Without that, adolescence is often a period of impulsiveness, reactionary, and unteachable. So as I look at the demographics of this congregation, you have a lot of children. You have now are now beginning to get some young people, as I'm using the term, but well, these children are going to become young people. And as a congregation, and I applaud you for everything I've seen that you've done so far, it is very imperative, not simply as parents and grandparents, but as a congregation, we take that very seriously. As we grow up, we have to learn to live with uncertainty. We have to learn to suppress immediate gratification for the good of long-range goals. How many adults do you know that have not learned that lesson? They haven't learned the concept of delaying immediate gratification for the long-term goal. No, we're very much of an immediate gratification society. That's why we want instant potatoes, instant milk, instant oatmeal, because we don't want to wait. Well, I don't think it's a sin to eat instant potatoes and instant oatmeal, but it is symptomatic of our mindset. Youth is a time when a young person develops very clever efforts to retain the privilege of childhood while at the same time demanding the results of the rights of adulthood. I'm going to repeat that. It's a time when we want to retain the privilege of childhood but have and demand the rights of adulthood. And what that really means is we want all the rights of being an adult without the responsibilities of being an adult. And I just described a lot of adults when I said that, didn't I? So this is not just a youth-oriented thing. There probably isn't a teacher here or anyone that's dealt with younger people that doesn't very much understand that. The idea of, I want the privilege of being a child, but I want the rights of being an adult. That's a teenager who wants the rights of driving the car without the responsibility of putting any gas in it. It's a stage that, sadly, many people never come out of, and you may be sitting very close to some people that are still in that stage. I don't know. Do you realize that when Jesus left this earth, He left the church in the hands of a group of people between the ages of 18 and 30. We call them his apostles. In all likelihood, his apostles, when he left this earth, the original 12, all fit probably somewhere in that age group. These weren't 50, 60-year-old men. They weren't seasoned. How long had Peter been a Christian when Jesus left? 3 years? 4 years? I'd say four at the max. In terms of a follower of Christ, obviously the church didn't begin till the day of Pentecost. I'm going to turn to Matthew chapter 10 and read a few verses and then make a few comments. In Matthew chapter 10, I'm going to be looking at the first 10 verses. And when he called them, this is his apostles, unto him, his 12 disciples, he gave them power against unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all manner of sickness and all manner of disease. Now the names of the 12 apostles were these. The first is Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother, Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, Matthew, and Alphaeus, James the son of Alphaeus, and Lebedus, whose surname was Thaddeus, Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. These 12 Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, go not into the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans. Enter ye in, but rather go unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. Freely you have received, freely you give. Provide neither gold nor silver, nor brass in your purses, nor scrip in your journey, neither two coats, neither shoes, nor staves, for the workman is worthy of his hire. Jesus is sending these 12 young men, these 12 young men out on a tremendous mission. And as I go through those verses, there's three points I'd like to make that I think can help us as congregations and as individuals as we try to encourage our youth, whether you're their parent or not. Number one, there was companionship. He didn't just send one out, he sent the group out. In Mark chapter 6, verse 7, it says he sent them two by two, so he may have sent six groups of two, but he didn't send them alone. You know, when you go in a group, when you have companionship, you're encouraged when you're surrounded by that. We all crave companionship. Sometimes as we get older, we kind of think we don't anymore, but we do. But certainly as young people in the Lord, we crave that companionship. Solomon writes in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 9, in a passage that we often use in weddings, two are better than one. And for several reasons. Number one, they get a better return for their labor. If one falls, the other can help them up. We keep each other warm. And if attacked, we have help. Now, what does that have to do with this? Well, I want to share with some of my thoughts on things that I think as a congregation and as all of us can do to help ensure that this generation coming up is as successful as we can possibly make it spiritually. When I was in my mid-teens, my home congregation then was Martinsville, Indiana, and we hosted a Labor Day meeting. A couple of married couples came to that Labor Day meeting and they stayed with us. One couple was Doug and Sally Weekly. The other one was Frank and Clara Green. They now attend the church at Old Amin. Doug's a elder there. I was with them just a couple of weeks ago. I had no idea who they were. And decades passed before I saw them again. But from that relationship, that brief relationship back in the late 1960s, which is a few years ago, I still have a very warm relationship with those four people. The first time I can mentally recall meeting Duane Stoops was probably in the late 60s, and if I recall right, he was traveling with Tom Dennis, and I think they were at Bloomington, Indiana, which was close to where I lived. I had no idea what a Duane Stoops was. Never heard of a Duane Stoops. Didn't really give it too much of a thought. I thought, well, that's nice. He's keeping Tom company. There was a little more to it than that. Now I look back 50 years later, and have developed a relationship with him, working on projects with him. Who'd have thunk it, pardon my good English, that 50 years ago that encounter would have developed into the relationship that I have. The late 1960s, my home congregation, Martinsville, Indiana, hosted the two-week meeting, and we kept a couple of teenage boys. One of them was Lowell Herman. Some of you know Lowell. He's now an elder at Pleasant Hill, Iowa. Been my friend ever since. The other one we kept was a young man named Rick Sparks. We had no idea that as the years went on, we would be co-evangelists, if that's the right term, and that that relationship would, don't repeat this to him, but if that that relationship would come to probably mean as much as it does to both of us. Those are relationships that we can develop in our youth if we as adults promote it, that can serve all of us well and our youth well. When I was 14, and please, I'm not trying to talk about myself, I'm just the only person I know. When I was 14, I had just been baptized. One of the elders of our congregation in Martinsville, a man by the name of Chick Powell, he wrote one of the songs in our Red Songbook. He baptized me. He had a big, long station wagon. Now, I guess that's what the minivan has replaced. He was in his mid-60s. I didn't think too much about it. He came to the young people of our congregation, and he said, "Does anybody want to go to the Vandalia weekend meeting?" Well, I said yes, because that's a weekend away from Mom and Dad, so I didn't know anything about Vandalia, but I liked the sound of that. So about five of us piled into his station wagon, and this 65 or 66-year-old man drove all night to get us to Vandalia, Iowa. In 1962 or three, bailed out of his station wagon as he pulled up in front of Marvin and Melda Ingalls' house. And if you've been to Vandalia, you know it well. That is the first time I ever met Marvin and Melda. I had heard their names because of my dad. They had a little boy named Greg, who's now a doctor and an elder. And it has developed into a 55-year-old relationship. Marvin married Donna and I. I stood up with his son Greg at his wedding. All because somebody in our congregation, I'm going to call him an old man, he's dead now, was willing to take four or five teenagers to a meeting. My first two-week meeting was 1964. It was at the old Craig Road meeting. The next two-week meeting I went to was 1967 at Gregory Boulevard, and I met a young lady named Donna Seekman, who is still with me. That is not the only way to meet your mate. It may not even be the best way. I'm saying that the relationships that we can foster our young people to develop can be lifelong things that will serve them well in the Lord. Will serve them well in the Lord. I also notice here in Matthew chapter 10 that he delegated authority to these young men. I think that's extremely important with our youth. You have probably, some of you, gone to meetings. I'll just say a weekend meeting. And usually they take one or two forms. They're doctrinal. But in some of these meetings, the elders will get up and make all the announcements, or they'll have an evangelist kind of coordinate everything. But then you go to another congregation and they have their young people do some of that. Now, which is the best? Well, there isn't a right or a wrong. But I think in the long term, getting our young people involved, getting all of us involved, but especially our young people, involved people tend to stay. And then the latter part of this passage in Matthew 10, not to belabor it, he talks about keeping material things in perspective. How our walk must match our talk, whether it's work, recreation, or morality. I believe the saying that faith is better caught than taught is probably true. Our faith and our doctrine needs to be taught to each of us. But it's seeing people do it is how we catch it. I can count on one hand the times my dad, and I wish we had done it more, I can count on one hand the times my dad and I sat down and had a spiritual conversation. I don't have enough hands collectively with you to know the times that he showed me spiritual lessons by the way he conducted himself. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't sit down and talk to one another about it. I'm just saying the actions do obviously speak so much louder than words. I never doubted what he believed. I never doubted what he wanted me to believe. But he showed me. And we can do that one for another. If our lives are driven by our five senses, then we're simply not mature. And that's why Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians we are to walk by faith and not by sight. He's not saying close your eyes and walk. He's saying be driven by your faith in the Lord, not by your senses. And materialism is a sense. It appeals to our senses. If I am driven by what I see, what I touch, what I smell, I'm immature. It's not that those things are wrong, but they're simply not enough. A mature life derives its focus from the invisible world. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 18. Paul in Colossians chapter 3, verse 1 and 2 says what? Set your affections on what? Things above. There have been a lot of people who have lived and died that I admired tremendously, who taught me lessons that they don't know they taught me. I mentioned going to some two-week meetings, and I'm not up here telling you you have to do that. We may never have another two-week meeting. I'm not saying you have to do that to be saved. I'm just saying it's a tremendous opportunity for us and for our young people. When I, in my early 20s, would go to these two-week meetings, two men just stood out to me. I don't know. Well, I do know why. One of them was Richard Riggins. He just had so much knowledge that I want him to do one of those E.T. mind melds. I guess E.T. wasn't out then, but it came later. And the other one was a man you are very close to, Jim Basinger. And I found Jim not only to be knowledgeable, he just had this booming presentation that I knew it had to be true because it sounded so true. I'm just glad it was. He had that ability. I don't know that I ever told either one of those men how much they meant to me, informing me in that 17 to 22 year old range that really determines what you're going to end up doing largely with your life. Remember the story of Peter Pan? That's a story about a little boy who never grew up. And he just remains a 13, 14 year old adolescent. Well, that's not what we want for ourselves. It's not what we want for our children. So what do we do? Well, I've touched on a few of those things, but before I close, let me try to give you some maybe practical summation of things that as a congregation, as fellow Christians, we can do for one another, we can do for our young people, because there are going to be young people that are going to look up to you, even though you may not be related to them, and they may look up to you because you're not related to them. Sometimes words mean a lot different coming from someone who's not mom and dad, and I'm awful thankful with our boys they had people that would talk to them who weren't mom and dad. I can go away from my home congregation, give the exact same sermon, and it'll have a different impact when I'm 100 miles away from home than it does when I'm at home. A little bit about the prophet is without honor in his own home, maybe. But we need, number one, if I was to list a few things, give them the right model. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, which you'll, I guess, get to some shortly in your adult class, because you're in chapter 3, in verse 11, the following, it says, "Be ye an example," and then it lists five or six things, in speech, in love. Be examples. Paul was telling Timothy, be an example. Yeah, he was telling Timothy to talk the talk, but he was telling him to be an example. I think it's appropriate for in the church for us to set expectations for one another. Not force our young people in this particular sense to do it, but we kind of expect and we look forward to you participating in the service. I'm not talking about twisting their arm to which we drive them away. But many of you are active in the church because it was just kind of assumed you would be, and I don't think that's wrong. I think it's important to delegate, not simply to our young men to get behind the pulpit, but for our young ladies to begin taking their turns teaching and doing various things. People need to feel needed. I have no idea what you do, so this is no commentary, and there isn't a right or wrong, but at our home congregation, we could afford to hire somebody to clean the building and mow the grass. But we don't. We still take turns cleaning the building and mowing the grass. Why? Because we have members that aren't comfortable doing what I'm doing right now, but are comfortable doing that, and it allows them to feel participatory in the congregation. Now, if you hire people to do that, that is not wrong. That's not my point. We just need to look for ways to involve people. I remember we had a new couple joined our church. They had never been in the Church of Christ in 1994, and we hosted our first two-week meeting. They signed up to clean the building during the two-week meeting, had no idea what they were getting into. We all came in and helped them out. But they felt needed. A little overwhelmed, but they felt needed, and they're still with us 22 years later. I'm not saying because of that, but it was part of it. It was part of it. You know how children learn to talk, and if we've got a speech pathologist in the audience, you can correct me later. There are approximately 6,500 languages in the world. But there are only 150 different sounds that our mouth can make. The English language only uses 44 of those sounds. They're called phonemes or phonemes. When we are babies, we learn which sound to reproduce by the reaction of people around us. So when a little baby even gets close to saying something that sounds like a D, we get excited because, oh, he's about to say dad. Or anything close to an M, oh, they're about to say mom, and we get excited. What does that teach that young child? Do it again. They like that. I'll just have fun with these old folks. And pretty soon they start saying mom or dad. They don't know why they're doing that. I mean, come on, get off your ego trip. They're doing it because you got excited when they got close to it. My point is they learn their language by the reaction of those around us when they're learning it. There are languages that use, I can't do it. They use clicks and clucks. You've probably seen this on TV. I can't do that because I wasn't trained. My parents didn't get excited when I clicked and clucked. Neither did yours, so we didn't develop that. But if I had been raised in that language, they would have got excited when I clucked and clicked, and that's the way I'd talk. You can't learn those languages as an adult. You can learn some European languages that have the same sounds we use, but you can't learn. You remember back in the Old Testament, I think this is in Judges chapter 12, the Gideonites and the Ephraimites had a battle, and the Ephraimites were wanting to come back over Jordan, and they had to say this one word to get in. And the Ephraimites couldn't say it because they had never been taught how to say SH. So they just butchered it. Now, we learn by observing, and we learn by being the encouragement we get while we're learning. That transcends language. Now, most of our children are going to learn English, but they may learn some other things from us too, might they? They may not only learn the 44 sounds, they may learn some words. Not here, because I'm not with you enough, but it is troubling with me when I hear what should be pillars in the church using some of the words that I hear them use. I don't even want to say them. And are they going to be lost because they've said that word? Well, that's not my judgment. But it doesn't bespeak the example. Parents are chagrined when their kids sometimes say things only that have been the very things they've heard. As they get older, enabling becomes sometimes a very difficult thing. To discipline without enabling. And I'm not sure I know the answer to this because I've not personally been faced with it. We all want to help our children, no matter their age. But there are times when helping them in that way is not helping them. It becomes enabling, doesn't it? I think you ladies maybe have a little harder time with this than us men because you're more compassionate. That makes you softer, and we need that. A dad is more likely to say they made their bed, let them lay in it. And the mom is more likely to say, well, they got to have a bed to lay in. I like a lady at Topeka. She's now dead, but she had three daughters. And someone asked her one time, how are you going to keep your kids from coming back to you when things go wrong? She said, I sell their beds. Now, that's not saying that it's wrong for your children to come back and live with you if they're having a particularly hard time. I'm just simply saying we need to be careful. No matter what their age is. We need to provide the opportunity for peer relationships. No matter how good of a parent, no matter how good of an evangelist or a deacon or an elder one is, it doesn't matter. People need peer relationships. Peer relationships. This summer, Smart Road hosted since there wasn't a two-week meeting, and I had nothing to do with this, so I take zero credit, maybe I take minus 10 credit. The congregation hosted a class for the high school and college kids. There was 50-some kids that came. My understanding is it was outstanding, to the point that there was a baptism, which is always good, but a young man in his teens who was fighting a particular addiction admitted it to the whole group and asked for their prayers. But I thought, as I looked at the picture of those young people, how many friendships and relationships are going to be there maybe 40, 50 years from now? A Lowell Herman, a Rick Sparks, or whomever their people are. I doubt this is a real problem here, but I have it on my list. Teach them how to work. There was a man in my home congregation, his name was Woody Estes. I doubt any of you knew him. Dwayne might have. He's dead. He taught me how to work. My dad was gone a lot. My dad was a hard worker, but he didn't teach me how to work because he wasn't home that much. Woody Estes taught me how to work. He owned a bakery, and I worked for him for 8 years through high school and college. There were nights I thought I was going to die. I look back with great appreciation because he taught me how to work. As we become more urban, chores become less frequent. And I'm not telling you how to raise your family. I'm just saying you do them a favor when you teach them how to work, even at this age. Who else is going to take care of you when you're old? And teach them, please teach them how to handle money. It is absolutely amazing to me how many people don't know how to handle money. Absolutely amazing. And I don't mean that to be critical, and there may not be anybody here in that category. My wife worked at a grade school for 30 years, and I know some of you did. Tony did. Others of you have been teachers. she was amazed. And these, you know, teachers, I'm not saying they're rich, but they make enough to live on. And if you got a man and a wife, both, she said it's amazing how many of the teachers she worked with were literally month to month. That's beyond my grasp. Now, things can happen to give us difficulty financially. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about not being good stewards of what God gives us. And you have seen example after example of it's not what a person makes, it's what they do with what they make that makes the difference, isn't it? Teaching our children. I remember growing up, of course, there's been inflation, but my mom would give every week she'd put a quarter into our bank account. So at the end of the year, I'd have $12.50, roughly. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. Every week, I got 50-cent allowance. I don't care whether you give allowances or not. But I was supposed to put a quarter in. That's 50%. Gulp. I was down to only being able to afford two knee highs and one moon pie. After that, lessons that we need to teach. And this isn't simply parent teaching. This is congregational teaching. When I go to Eminence, there's things I like about Eminence and things that maybe I would change, but that's neither here nor there. But I look at parents who sometimes are just working themselves to death. I see a mother out there cooking meal after meal after meal and sweat's dripping down her face. And I say, why in the world is she here? And then I see her children out playing with other children or her young teenagers playing with other young teenagers. And I think, I know why she's here. When meetings come up, we can't go to all of them. And I'm not saying you have to go to any of them, but I'm saying that's an opportunity to expose our youth and give them that building up, developing friendships. And it's easier not to do that because that's work. I don't want to say to drag two or three young kids to a meeting is not easy. That's not easy. And I appreciate that you can't do that all the time. I am saying, however, at least personally, there are relationships that are built that way. I know Ben's mother because of meetings in Des Moines, Iowa, 50 years ago. She was an Engel back then. She's a Morris now. And there's not a lot of difference, just the spelling of the name. I can look out here and make that statement about many of you. And those are things that I absolutely cherish. And I know that some of you as adults do also. So if we cherish them, let's help our young people have them also. We're going to close our thoughts. Just remember, this is not just about the physical parent responsibility or the grandparent responsibility, although that is very much true. I wasn't related to Chick Powell, except he was my brother in Christ. I didn't appreciate how hard it was for him to drive all night with four or five immature teenagers in his station wagon, but he did it because he loved us. There may be ways that we, that even aren't related to one another, physically can serve one another in that way. There's a term we often use about death. And we'll say, well, they crossed over Jordan. Or they went over the chilly waters of Jordan. All kinds of euphemisms we come use rather than saying they die. I understand what we mean by that because the children of Israel crossed Jordan, went into the promised land, and we hope to cross Jordan and go into heaven. But there's a lot of inaccuracy about that. When the children of Israel crossed Jordan, they still had to fight. They still had enemies. They still had struggles. They still had difficulties. But when you and I cross Jordan in that metaphorical sense, there's no enemies in heaven. There's no fighting in heaven. There's no struggles in heaven. It is peace. We're not there yet. but we take a step there closer every day, don't we? As we extend the gospel invitation, this is in preparation to when we do cross over Jordan. When we don't have to struggle with some of the things we have to struggle with. This congregation is so blessed right now. I wish I could convey to you, and maybe you know it, how blessed you are. I remember coming down here 20 years ago, and there'd be about 20 people here, and I was one of the youngest. A lot of you weren't even born 20 years. Some of you weren't even born 20 years ago, and you sure weren't here. It's just wonderful to see what happens when we take care of our youth and when we stay firm. I remember, again, talking to Jim Basinger once, and he said, at that time, he said, the only reason there's still a congregation at Ozark is we were too stubborn to give up. God bless him, and God bless all of those who didn't give up. And I hope they can enjoy the fruit that I'm able to look at today. If we can help anybody in any way, we invite you to come as we stand and as we sing.